The county's number one talk show, the 9 till noon show on Highland Radio.
And you're very welcome back to the programme this Monday morning. How are you all keeping? I do hope you are very well indeed. And thanks for choosing the 9 till noon show. It's greatly appreciated. Okay, let's get to some of your comments coming in so far this morning. It's not just doctors and nurses. It's the admin staff who are under severe pressure with not enough staff and getting blamed by doctors for problems that are not theirs. Indeed, listen, thank you for the insight there. It's not a voice you often hear, so I do appreciate it. Greg, Letterkenny ED is like a war zone hospital, just people lined up everywhere. My daughter waited 13 hours to just see a doctor to begin with and spent 26 hours waiting in a wheelchair and then was admitted to a bed in a corridor. I stood for 23 of those 26 hours because there wasn't a spare seat as there was only enough for patients. Traumatic experience for the people of Donegal. And that is a horrendously traumatic experience there. A caller says it's not just the ED, the oncology department is also a shambles. I'm decided to withdraw treatment because I cannot cope with the strain it takes on me mentally. A different doctor every week, it's chaos and it's awful. I feel like a pincushion, it's so terrible. I'm now choosing to stop treatment rather than to suffer on like this. Well, that's a very difficult text to read, to be honest with you. I can't imagine what it must have been like to write, but it's a listener who's withdrawing treatment, presumably for cancer. Because they can't cope with the strain it takes on them mentally. Different doctor every week. They feel like a pincushion. So they're actually stopping treatment rather than continuing as they see it, as they feel it, of course, to suffer on like this. I'm really sorry to hear to read that. As part of the research as to where the money is going in the hospital, has anyone looked into what was the budget, what is being spent on? How much is being spent on travel and subsidies for staff? And why is it not being spent in more crucial areas, asks a listener there. My mum was in last year and done a 28-hour sit on a hard chair. And so when I was in a few weeks ago with my father, I thought it's just the same, if not worse. Sadly, my father passed away just 2 days after he was sent home. I don't believe it was in any way linked at all, but it's tough to see people who need immediate attention having to go through the drill of waiting that long. And I think that's a really fair text, and I'm sorry for your loss, but I think it's really fair to point out that you don't believe that that impacted on your father's passing, but still very stressful for all of you nonetheless. Okay, we want you to keep them coming in to us, please. 086 60 25000, WhatsApps and texts to this number. There's a push on at the moment. We're at a tipping point, according to consultants, or nearing it. You've heard from 78 GPs, you'll hear from consultants later, and we want to hear from you, the public, as to your experiences, your opinions on Letterkenny University Hospital. 07491 25000 if you wish to speak to Donna Marie. Okay, you're very welcome back to the programme. Now, Polestar roundabout lights are coming into effect from tomorrow. It's all, I presume, it is designed to help traffic move more freely. So let's try and get an understanding of how it will work, how long it might take to be really effective, and so on and so forth. Damien McDermott is Senior Engineer with the Donegal National Roads Office, and he joins us now. Good morning to you.
How are you doing, Greg?
Good to have you on board. Okay, I mean, it seems pretty obvious, but why were these traffic lights then? Why was it deemed that this was the solution going forward?
Well, when it comes to dealing with traffic flows and high traffic flows such as you have in Letterkenny at the Polestar, roundups are a good solution, but signalised junctions are the most efficient solution and the most robust and reliable solution for ensuring traffic gets through. It's also a safer solution for pedestrians and cyclists in an urban area. So it's a natural progression. If you look around the country, if you look at the likes of Galway or Dublin, these places, you'll see that the progression from normal junctions to roundabout junctions, then on to signalised junctions in that order. It's the natural progression here as well. Obviously, we have all serious problems with traffic flows in Letterkenny. This is not a solution to all those traffic flows. It should give us some better reliabilities. And I suppose, consistency in how junctions are used. Obviously, look, we need things like the 10T to remove the strategic traffic and move traffic volumes from our town centre. Otherwise, really, there's only so much we can do.
Yeah, you can put in the infrastructure, but there's I don't know what the percentage is, but a significant percentage is driver responsibility to adhere to the lights, to understand lanes, right of ways, and all that kind of basic stuff. I mean, we have our role to play in this as well. Before we sort of get into the nitty gritties of it, Where are people likely to see less congestion as a result? You know, so say, for instance, coming in on the four lanes, sometimes it can be backed out right as far as the roundabout there at the bottom of Lurgy Brack. And other people will experience traffic issues in other areas. So, you know, will this, do you think this will speed up people's commute?
No, I mean, look, to be fair, you have to look at it. We're not removing any traffic. So the same volumes were there before are going to be there now. So we have those massive volumes at times, which does occur, particularly coming the Remelton Road and stuff like that, to carry on for Polestar. They're still going to be there. The best example I would give would be McLeay's Corner in Stirawler, where there was no lights for a long period of time. And what you had there was you had times where people just couldn't get out of the junction, where you might turn up there, you might feel that you could never get out there because it was reliable on people's judgments coming out at the junction, excuse me. And as such, when we put the lights in there, although you still have significant queues in Balbriggan and obviously a bypass is needed there, you know that when you come in from the Leicester Kenny side, you know that if you may have to wait a few phases, you may be in a fairly long queue, but you know that you're going to get out at the junction. And that's what we're providing here. It's not going to reduce the traffic problems. It's not going to even reduce traffic queues in places. But you should know that you're not going to get stuck endlessly in a queue, that you should be able to, or where one leg gets stuck or queued up, other legs will still be able to perform okay, and not every leg will get blocked up.
Yeah.
So it's really just managing the flows as opposed to reducing them. So, you know, we would hope to see that when you have major flows coming one direction, for example, it was coming in from the Remelton Road side of Mount Errigal, that the other legs around it would not have a knock-on backup effect on them, or less so.
Mm-hmm.
All right, it tends to even out the flows a wee bit. You may actually have some slower traffic coming in from the other legs to allow the Remelton Road to move a bit quicker. So it does. It should balance things out as well at the junction somewhat.
How complex is this junction in terms of, you know, you've got traffic lights at four entrants, you've got traffic lights actually on the roundabout, and you actually also have pedestrian crossings. I presume it's not unprecedented, but how complex is that to calibrate?
It's a fairly standard type, but it's complex insofar as that you're dealing with the traffic flows to come in. But there are sensors out the road that deal with that.
Mm.
It can only do so much. It's not going to be a free thinking roundabout. It can actually adjust very rapidly. But it should be able to sense where the traffic volumes are building up and to deal with them somewhat efficiently. It will be also tied into other works. This is only phase one of an overall traffic management. Obviously, the four-lane road is one element of that. And then obviously we're going to be working through next year, hoping to put the Ballyrain roundabout and Ballyrain Junction and the Creamy Junction. And both of those will likely be signalised as well. And they'll be tied into this system as well. So that'll extend the ability of the system to adjust them because it'll be linked into more junctions.
So just so we have an understanding and to manage expectations, because you know yourself, I'm sure, Damien, there's going to be a lot of interest in these lights. Are the majority of people going to see no difference? Are the majority of people going to see, you know, things moving a bit clearly for them? Are more people, if they have a certain routes, is it possible that they might see further delays because to balance all the traffic out? I mean, help us manage our expectations here.
I think what you'll see is you'll see right, but you'll know that when you approach the junction from any side, that you know you may have to wait, but you are going to get to the junction. And then when you get to the junction, you're not taking a chance regarding how you get out there. I think that's a lot of people have concern with trying to get out on the roundabout as is at the moment. You know, taking that chance, pulling out in front of what is often fairly fast-moving traffic on the roundabout. But it should be simple for people. It must be simpler and safer for people to get across there. And it should be more reliable. You should hope, except for those extraordinary periods where we get extraordinary tailbacks, the rest of the time it should be a fairly simple process. You pull up, you know you'll get your signal, you'll get your time to use the roundabout, and you'll get through the junction safely. So I think that's the thing. It's all about reliability, safety, and it should be easy to use. There are examples of this in Dublin and Cork. I think there's one in a couple in Derry as well. You know, they're not unusual junctions. Normally we just have a signalised junction itself, but in this case we have to signalise the roundabout because we need that ability to turn back round again and go back down the four-lane road. But look, I think it's all about reliability, knowing that you're going to get through this, but you don't have to worry about having to get out at the roundabout like you do at the moment. That's one of the big things.
Yeah, sometimes you have people using the wrong lane to expedite their exit. That's going to be more difficult with the light system. I mean, it's going to be imperative, isn't it, that people are in the correct lane, dependent where they want to go, because sometimes you get three cars trying to go into, one exit. So people need to have a look at the maps and familiarise themselves where they most often approach from, which lane to go into.
Yeah, it should be the whole point of the signage and the lining approaching the roundabout should be very clear for people, because obviously if you know the place, that's one thing. We have to deal with people who don't know the area, and I suppose you're right to a certain extent. People who are accustomed to things do what they normally do, as opposed to looking at the signage and lining maybe. So probably would ask the locals particularly to pay attention to the signing and lining. I think people who are strangers to the area tend to do that in much more detail and have less problems with these things than maybe locals will have. So, yes, I would agree with you that people that thought maybe we just take a little more time to look at the signs and lines and get themselves into the right position going to the roundabouts. There's no, the whole point of the roundabout, it tells you what to do. You need to follow the rules on it. If not, a normal roundabout circumstance.
You say that like it's simple, Damien, but I'm convinced most people don't know how to use roundabouts. But hopefully this will be the catalyst for change. So it's going to take a while, presumably, to calibrate. Did I read correctly? There's a 2-week period to get things running as smoothly as possible, because people have one eye too on other traffic lights being switched on.
Absolutely. Look, I think the key thing here, first of all, is that they'll start putting into operation tomorrow afternoon. They'll have a look and see how it operates, first of all. That might run through peak hour or not, depending on how it's running. And we'll keep tweaking it then. The people who are installing the lights for us, the experts on this, will be there for a couple of weeks to ensure that, because they want to see how it's operating, how day and night. And then there's obviously a Friday, it'll be a big period, there'll be peak periods of flow as well, to see how it's responding to that. The lights themselves, the sensors have to sort of somewhat calibrate and see, they get into a sort of a routine with regard to the traffic volumes that are coming over them. And, there may be sensors maybe in the wrong place to pick up traffic flows. So we may have to adjust that as well. So it's going to be an iterative process over the next 4 to 6 weeks, longer if need be, to make sure they get optimum usage out of them, make sure they're working the best for the public.
Yeah, because, when it's really, really busy, you'll get calls to programmes like this saying, well, where are the guards directing traffic? This is really permanent traffic management. This is really what a lot of the public are asking for, that hope that you will get out, that, other motorists are going to be stopped to eventually allow you out. So we shouldn't then, because it's important to manage expectations, and I'm conscious that you're on now and you might not be on when people text in. This is not necessarily about all of a sudden, everyone gets to work or school or wherever 10 minutes quicker. This is about the management of the traffic is there to get it to move as freely as possible and to let people know that they are going to get out of junctions.
Yes, that is essential. That's it in a nutshell. And, it's first part of the process. Look, we'd hope with all our other products, including the 10T, that those other traffic problems issues can be improved as we go forward. But we have to deal with what we have there at the moment. And I think this is an important first step. And look, it's lights. It's important people, you stop when you see the red, as long as we don't have people obeying the rules of the road and being considerate to other motorists who may be in the wrong lane and things like that, starting off, I think that's important. Yeah. And people generally are fairly good that way, I think.
And correct me if I'm wrong, I think this is an important element of this, Damien. People up until now would be driving up towards the yields line, so to speak. You're going to be stopped much further back than that now. So I think that's where people might get a little bit confused, or there could be some teething problems, because instinctively you drive up to that line. Now you are back and you're instructed by the lights as to when to go.
Yes, absolutely. It's the lights are the key position that you have to look for. I think that's important for people. I think, in fairness, look, I know people in Donegal may not see lights that much, but they see them when they go to Derry. You have them in Sligo a lot, so there should be no reason. I think the overhead lights are a good thing as well, to give you an idea where your lane is. I mean, there's plenty of signs there. So, that's the worry at the start, that people may miss it or go back to their old habits of stopping where they shouldn't do. But look, I think there'll be enough people out there to ensure that doesn't happen, and we'll try and hopefully there won't be any instances. I mean, I can imagine there might be a few rear-end jumps starting off, potentially people braking and doing the wrong thing. We'll just have to manage that as best we can.
Okay, and just one other thing, not looking to pick problems, but say, for instance, you get a 40-footer that is stopped in the middle of the roundabout, with the lights that are actually on the roundabout, so to speak. Is that roundabout big enough that allows other traffic to navigate the roundabout in the lanes that they can progress in? Or you have you any concern that the large vehicles...
Well, we shouldn't have, because, I mean, the 44s are going round at the moment, Greg, so there should be no reason. I mean, it's the same lanes that they were using previously, so there should be no reason. Anytime you have a big lorry like that, and if it's not driven properly, it might go across lane, so you have to be cautious of that. But the roundabout hasn't changed in size or dimension, so there shouldn't be a problem.
All right, okay. We shall see. We'll wait with bated breath. It's exciting, Damien.
No problem at all, Greg.
Take care of yourself. Bye-bye. Damien McDermott there. He's a senior engineer with the Donegal National Roads Office, and we appreciate him coming on to talk to us. If you want to check out which lane you should be in and what have you, if you search Highland and Polestar in Google, the second story down is images of the new layout. So that might be helpful to you. And you heard from Damien there. Unfortunately, there might be a few shunts as people panic and slam the brakes on. So no one wants to have to deal with that on the way to work or hospital or school. So just be extra cautious of that. Is the Port roundabout big enough to be signalled? Those roundabouts are massive in comparison. Would the junction be better if signalled with no roundabout at the Port, asks a caller. Greg, we won't need Christmas lights in Letterkenny this year, as there's so many traffic lights in the town. They'll suffice. Absolutely crazy. Looking forward to seeing what's going to happen after lights are switched on at the Polestar. It could be, this listener believes, total mayhem. But again, to manage one's expectations, the traffic, there's not going to be any less traffic. I think it's going to be, you know, we are creatures of habit, and when we leave the house, for some, they might be able to leave a little later. For others, they might have to leave a little earlier. All the same cars, lorries, trucks, whatever they might be, all have to use those roads. This is about managing that. So we'll see. We'll see how it goes. I know you'll keep us updated. Right. The need for foster parents is at an all-time high due to the increased demands of children's needs. That's the warning from Tusla. It's launched its National Fostering Week today. Ireland is one of the world leaders in foster care, with almost 4,000 foster carers opening their homes to over 5,000 children. Amongst them, Rosie, who joins us on the programme now. Hi, Rosie.
Good morning, Greg.
How are you getting on?
Oh, not too bad. Not too bad. I'd be better looking after the kids than I'll be at this interview. But
well, I'll not let you keep you too long, because it's important, Rosie. You've been fostering now for over 30 years, haven't you? Why would you encourage others to do so?
It's very rewarding work. It's hard to explain. We started fostering over 30 years ago. We've had 46 fabulous children come to our doors, and it can be hard work, but it's worth it. And if you make a difference in a child's life, if you can help parents be reunited with their children, there's so many things in fostering that make it so, so worthwhile.
And I suppose, Rosie, it's like everything, isn't it, in life? Life is not easy. There are good times and bad, but your experience is that the good times far outweigh the bad.
Oh, they do. They do. The positives far outweigh the negatives in fostering. We have a great team of social workers in Donegal that really do support and care for us, and see to the children's needs. It makes the work so much easier.
That's really important, isn't it, Rosie, to have those supports, that you're not left on your own?
It is. You know, even when you come against challenges and things are not easy, you're guided, mentored through it. And if you work closely with your social workers, you have to work closely with teachers, sometimes doctors, hospitals, whatever, therapists, you will get through it. And every day is a learning day. Every day is a school day in fostering. Things are changing. We're being offered training, constant training in different aspects of childcare. And it's really, really interesting work. Busy work, and that we do a lot of running and toing and froing, and now towards the where the Golden Old is, and we have two very special little men, and yeah, we have a lot of running with them. They're an absolute joy.
Rosie, it's one of the more difficult elements of it, you know, building bonds with children, really, with the aim, of course, to returning them to their families. Is that one of the more difficult parts, or perhaps it's not difficult at all?
No, it's bonding with children. Again, you do get training, and we get training and attachment, and after a while you get fairly good at it,
yeah. In
that, you know, their special tips and ways of creating bonds,
mm-hmm.
that you just get more used to it, and you don't expect any child to come through your door and to be your best friend from the minute they arrive. You do have to work at it.
And what is your what do you think the greatest is patience one of the greatest
you have to be patient, you have to be willing to learn and to love kids.
Yeah.
You have to, and a couple must work together on it if it's a couple. But we have single foster parents, and they're doing brilliant work. Mm. They're doing fabulous work. But a couple need to want to do it together, and my goodness, it is just so rewarding. And when you see children progress from no self-esteem and then become the confident little people that you want them to be.
Yeah, must feel like sounds like a gift, actually, to be able to have that power to impact on people's lives in such a positive way, Rosie.
Well, it's a privilege.
Privilege,
To be really, really honest about it, it's a privilege. We have two children at the moment, and it's an absolute privilege to have them in the house.
Okay.
And I can say, even the most difficult cases we've had, we've learned a lot from them. We've grown as people because of the challenges, and no. It's so worth. If anybody out there is thinking about it, go to an information night, find out more about it, because it is very, very doable.
Okay, and
it
I think
really
Justin, and I'll not hold you, but I think you said in a chat with Donna Marie that it's been a life-changing experience fostering for you and your hubby.
Absolutely, it's the one thing that I'm very grateful for that I did. Fall into by accident, sort of, but it's something we both love, and we've got more from than we could ever explain in words.
Well, that's lovely, Rosie. Listen, thanks so much for your time. I know you're keen to get back to your boys. Thank you very much indeed. That's Rosie there. If you want more information, there's going to be awareness campaigns across the country, and I'm sure across this region as well. And if there's any details of any open nights or any information nights, of course, we'll bring them to you. But that's Rosie's story. She is a foster carer for over 30 years. And you heard from herself there. So rewarding and a privilege. And it could be something you could be involved in too. 086 60 25000 WhatsApps and texts to that number, or give us a call on 074 91 25000. What a disaster the traffic was on Saturday. Part of the town was shut down, of course, for a show. Total gridlock thanks to the Lower Main Street being shut off. Had my elderly mother and baby in the car. Had an appointment down Lower Main Street for my mother. Couldn't get her home via Lower Main Street and ended up trapped in the circle round by the Radisson. Baby screaming in the car. Absolute nightmare. How did the motor show get planning to shut off a main thoroughfare on the busiest day in town? I mean, any time that you host events, significant events, of course, it's going to inconvenience some people. Right, OK. Mary T. Sweeney is chair of the Hospital Action Campaign and also AIM2 rep, of course. And Mary T, an interesting intervention from 11 consultants, one of which we'll hear from after 11, between they and the GPs and the work of groups like yours and DACC and what have you. I think we're getting to a point here, and you're muted there, Mary T. I think we're getting to a point whereby, you know, people are going to have to start listening to us.
100%. And for me, one of the greatest things is to hear the consultants and the GPs finally taking action, because they are who are needed to underpin this, to give it credibility. As in the group that we have formed, it was across the community, people that were retired having had years of experience in the hospital, and they're the people we need to target. The people, not just the patients that have had the first-hand experience, we need the internal staff to have the confidence to put information forward to a team that will take it on board. The reality is, why do we need a better hospital? Because I want a better hospital for me and my family and my community. And what's happening, because we are letting things slip, is in the hospital area that we're in, we looked for questions to get answers to what's happening with adverse incidents. And to me, these are the accidental incidents that cause, can lead to death in circumstances. And in the area we're in, the HSE won't give us a breakdown specifically for Letterkenny Hospital, but in this area, CHO Area 1, which is Cavan, Monaghan and Donegal, there's 50,911 adverse incidents recorded, which is the highest out of every area. Now, we're not allowed the figures specifically for Letterkenny Hospital, but the reality is that there was over 3,000 people have died in that area directly resulting from those adverse incidents. So we need the people to come together, the consultants, the doctors and the staff. Then we look at the figures, where the management figures, 26 million spent in 3 years on agency staff because we're not creating full-time jobs. If people haven't permanent jobs, they have no ownership of the hospital. And you know, when you teach in a class, you own that class. When you work in a community and a ward, you own that ward. You feel that the ward reflects you, and you want to reflect well in your ward and look after your patients. If we keep having, you know, transient staff and transient people, that's something that really needs to be addressed. I feel that it's not just agency staff, and the lure of the higher money being paid to agency staff has to be addressed.
Yeah, because of the fact. The thing too, though, Mary T, it doesn't matter whether it's a car, a house, a business, whatever it is, the amount of money you put into that will determine its quality. And it's impossible to square the circle that we have the sixth busiest hospital behind Cork, Limerick, Galway, Our Lady of Lourdes Hospital and the Mater in Dublin. So after those five big hospitals, we are sixth. And then you look at the funding, the annual budget, millions of euro, and 179,939, well down, but it's about 7,000 euro per patient, actually, effectively. We're second bottom of the pile. Like, it doesn't make any sense. You know, less than 7,000 euro per person, yet it's the sixth busiest hospital. Only St. Luke's in Kilkenny is behind us in terms of funding.
This is what I'm saying. It's not just about funding, Greg, if you do not look after your team and have a permanency to your team that are going to speak out when somebody needs to speak out, and they're going to stand up for their unit, for their ward, for their department that they're working in, and that team spirit. They must be respected and they must be supported, from the doctors to the housekeeping staff. The team spirit must be developed and fostered, and to start doing that, we need to find out what the team are saying is wrong internally. It can't come from one sector of the hospital. Internally, and there's structures from external structures that need to be addressed. We need to address the fact, is a teaching hospital the best way for us to go? Has that impacted on us? Is it because there's so many transient staff? Should that be reviewed and how it's delivered? You know, any organisation should have an external review and audit. We had a review and audit planned. The Scottish team were to come over. That never happened, Greg. We need independence in this. We need somebody coming in with experience to come in and talk openly, and we must have a very secure whistleblowers in that sense, that they can talk frankly and honestly to a team coming in that need to examine from the inside out, not from the outside in.
One thing that's worrying in terms of getting information out is that we're actually going backwards, because most people not be aware, as part of the new consultant's contract, they're forbidden from speaking out publicly. You know, so we have had, I don't know if you'd necessarily label them as whistleblowers in the sense that you've mentioned, but we've actually been lucky in that we've had consultants that would speak out, that would shine a light on the situation. Now going forward, if they've signed this new consultant's contract, that would actually be a breach of their contract. So why are they trying to shut them up?
This is the question that you need to ask the established politicians who are sitting on the Sealta group, why they have not spoke out about this. Why the politicians are the people best capable of stopping that from coming into the contract. That's a backward step, in my opinion. It takes an awful lot to get consultants to speak out, as you know, Greg. And many's the time I've heard them myself on your show, and I think they're extremely brave to do that. But we do need expertise, and we do need that ability that people internally can speak out, that you don't have to go to a journalist or a politician out the back door. There should be we need a complete review from the inside out of what's going on here. And it's not a matter of pointing fingers at a person individually. I'm not looking to name and shame or anybody in any department or ward or across the hospital group. But if we don't start being realistic about this, we're never going to fix it. And all we're doing is throwing good money after bad, and it's just the services is getting weaker and weaker, you know.
Yeah, okay. We'll see where we go from here. Thank you very much for your time this morning. I do appreciate it.
We just want to say we want to back the doctors and the consultants. Mm-hmm. We'd be delighted to get the opportunity to work with them. And one of the other figures that is frightening to mention is the amount of the millions that are spent in the adverse cases that are coming out through the hospital. And it's those adverse incidents where people are actually ending up dying, and the millions that are being spent on those cases, 2.4 billion has been spent in the last 5 years on adverse cases.
Well, there's another story in that, because much of that money is actually spent trying to discourage and frustrate any claims against before often an agreement is reached on the steps of the courts. An awful lot of that money
That didn't include the legal fees. Just 20% goes on top of that for legal fees.
Right, okay.
Scary stuff.
Mary T, thanks very much indeed. Mary T Sweeney of AINTHU, and also member of the chair of actually the Hospital Action Group. The HSE have released a response to our coverage. Letterkenny University Hospital, I can't read it all because it's incredibly long-winded. It's a very complex situation, so it's going to be long-winded. We'll reproduce this entire statement on our website, of course. Letterkenny University Hospital and the Sealta Group acknowledge the challenges facing the hospital and are taking all available steps to address these. The last 18 months has seen a very significant increase in demand to our services and infrastructure. The hospital has seen a 10% increase in ED attendance from January to August 2023 versus the same period in 2022. The hospital and group are working on a range of investments and development projects for LUH. We acknowledge that a number of our consultants have raised concerns in this regard, and we will continue to work with them to develop our capacity and enhance our services. An extension to the ED is being progressed in conjunction with the HSE estates. The development control plan for the site, which is currently being updated, will provide for the longer-term capacity requirements for the emergency department and will incorporate an enhanced medical assessment unit, surgical assessment unit, and a segregated paediatric emergency area. So if that is one of the calls that's being made, it'll incorporate an enhanced medical assessment unit and surgical assessment unit. LUH is also increasing staff within the ED. Three new consultants have been appointed to the ED since June, one of whom has already joined the team. LUH has also secured approval for a further 8 nurses and a healthcare assistant for the emergency department. Sealta has undertaken a bed capacity analysis for its hospitals across the region. It's identified a bed capacity requirement of 91 additional beds at LUH by 2030. The development control plan for the hospital will address this need and will also address the requirement to replace multi-ward accommodation with single rooms in the interim. Bed capacity remains under continuous review. Works underway across the group in LUH to address challenges to the radiology services, they say. A review of clinical workforce is already underway in LUH, and enhancements of the medical NCHD rotors and enhanced AMAU support for the medical rotor. And it's getting a bit technical here. In the interim, the hospital continues to focus on existing processes to optimise patient length of stay. There's also significant work taking place to progress discharges and treat patients in the community. This work includes liaising with community-based healthcare professionals about delayed transfers of care from LUH and working with the community intervention teams, which apparently is, from previous conversations, is producing some results. Letterkenny University Hospital is working closely with both community healthcare organisations and the National Ambulance Service to ensure all available care options are utilised and patients are directed to and provided with the proper care pathway. And as I say, it goes into many pages. The frailty at the front door service is also in place in the ED. This team assesses patients over the age of 75 with the aim to identify patients in need of frailty support and other assessments. Has anyone out there had the experience of the frailty at the front door service? Because I'm hearing from over 75s who are sitting for 12 hours. Let us know if you found that. And as I say, it goes on and on and on. Incredibly complex document. And I don't know. I'll have to go through it off air. I'm not sure if it's alphabet soup or if it's addressing the concerns of consultants. We might forward that on to the consultants just before we speak to them a little later on to see if that's addressing directly any of the concerns that they may have. Audrey's with us. Audrey, I'm sorry for holding you that long. Good morning to you.
Good morning. How are you?
I'm okay, Audrey. What was your experience of the health service?
Well, I'm currently on the way to Dublin to attend the Mater Private for cardiac care because I got misdiagnosed in Letterkenny on multiple occasions and didn't get the care or support that I needed, so I have to commute. I live 2 miles from Letterkenny Hospital, so I drove past the hospital this morning. So last September, I wasn't feeling well. I went to my doctor. I was experiencing palpitations, dizziness, you know, fainting episodes. Went over to my doctor and she acted fast. My heart rate was down in the 30s, quite low. Wow. She wanted an ambulance call straight away to get me over to Letterkenny General to have cardiac review carried out. And when I got there, I was told that there was no cardiac team. The no consultant, the consultant was on, I think, on annual leave, but there was no consultant in place to cover his leave. Over the next 35 or 6 hours, I seen, you know, number of nurses taking bloods. I had an ECG. But there was no cardiac team that came to see me. Mm-hmm. In the end up, I seen a consultant. He had read my notes from the doctor. He was aware of the situation. He went through family history. My father has cardiac issues and has since passed away. He said that he doesn't think it's cardiac related. He thinks maybe possibly chronic fatigue syndrome or possibly Lyme's disease. Now, I've never been bitten by a tick. I felt very deflated. I was given a prescription for a month's supply of antibiotics for Lyme's disease and went on my merry way home.
What did you
still feeling very unwell?
Yeah, before you move on, what was your GP's reaction to this? Because they thought you were so sick that they sent you by ambulance to the hospital. When you told them that you were sent home with antibiotics, were they shocked or did you have that conversation with them?
They laughed. They said, "I can't believe that, Audrey. I'm so sorry." And she said, "What do you want to do?" And I said, "I'll have to go to Dublin." I said, I can't go back there. She persisted that it was cardiac, and only for her, you know, she's just fantastic. She sent off the referral letter to Dublin. I'm originally from Dublin, so sent off the referral to Dublin. I was waiting, obviously with COVID and everything last year, things were backed up, you know, so I had to wait, you know, some time for an appointment. I do have private medical insurance, thank God. So I was able to kind of get in there. But in the meantime, I had another episode at the house whereby I was in and out of consciousness. My husband called an ambulance to the house and he couldn't move me. The ambulance came again. My heart rate was down in the low 30s and there was erratic arrhythmia behavior. I wasn't making much sense at all. Sat in the ambulance outside for, I think, 3 hours before I got into A&E. Then when I got into A&E, I again didn't see any cardiac team. I wasn't admitted. I seen some junior doctors, and again a consultant came in to me and asked me, do I stress or worry about my health, as in, you know, possibly a hypochondriac?
It's all in your head, effectively.
I said no. It's all in your head, basically, and maybe go home and practice mindfulness and, you know, and meditation. So I, again, just said, right, just get me out of here. My heart rate at that time was still below 60 beats, which is the normal beats, still showing bradycardic. So it was up around 51, still not feeling great, but I knew I wasn't going to get anywhere. So when they said they're just charging me out of emergency, I just went home. I knew I was going to be attending Dublin. So long story short, I've had fantastic care in Dublin. I was diagnosed with, after multiple testing, MRI, CAT scans, CT scans, echoes, Holter monitors, over a period of months up and down to Dublin. I have a condition called bradycardia, which is a lower than average heart rate, which can cause fainting and whatever, possibly long term I'll probably have to get a pacemaker fitted, like my father did. I also had an enlarged heart, which was causing a left ventricle lower percentage rate, and also I have an arrhythmia, so it was causing erratic palpitations and whatever, putting undue stress on my heart, as well as being bradycardic low. So I've had a procedure in Dublin called an ablation, and I'm currently on the way down. That was last February, and since then I've been up and down to Dublin seeing my team. Unfortunately, the procedure wasn't successful, so I will have to have another one done.
And like they're burning? They burn the valves or something?
Yes. It's either a hot or cold treatment.
So effectively, because we're just up against 11, you're spending, obviously having spent a lot of time away from your family and spending an absolute fortune as well for what really you'd expect
fortune
to get treated for locally.
I live 2 miles from the hospital. I drove past it this morning. I have family out looking after my children while I travel to Dublin. The cost of accommodation in Dublin, the cost of travelling to Dublin, the inconvenience of being away for another 3 days again. And this is going to be ongoing. You know, this is going to be something I have to attend, you know, every couple of months in Dublin. And again, have my procedure in Dublin and then have my husband come down, you know, with me and then drive me home after having a procedure, not feeling well in the car.
Okay.
You know, it's just terrific. And I live 2 miles from the hospital.